one of the best known and most important lines in the Haggadah. B'chol dor v'ador chayav adam lirot et atzmo ki'ilu hu yatza me'eretz Mitzrayim. In every generation, you should see yourself sitting there during the Seder as if you left Egypt. Now, if you think about it, this is a very strange time to be telling you this. You say it in between, pass the chicken, and can I have a little bit more fish? Surrounded in warmth and by family and by food, who can imagine that they're in the dust of the desert, poor and hungry and enslaved? So what does it mean? You have to imagine as if you left Egypt. Clearly, it's very difficult for those of us who are so blessed with so many things to picture ourselves as slaves in an ancient land. There's a disconnect. So what is it that we're supposed to share and feel that our ancestors also felt? I want to draw from the Seder, and in fact from life, three different lessons that are embodied in the experience of a slave leaving Egypt that in fact we can feel today, and we can understand today, and we can reproduce today, even though, thank God, we live in conditions of safety and of plenty. And the first, you understand from the question, Ma nishtana, what is different about this night from all other nights? When you ask that question, what are you supposed to feel? You're supposed to feel surprised. That's what the child is supposed to feel. He's supposed to look at what we do around the Seder table and feel surprised. Why are you eating that? Why are you doing this? And in fact, it is wonder and surprise and amazement that you can imagine the ancient Israelites felt that we too are supposed to feel. As the poet put it, surprised by joy, impatient as the wind. Isn't that exactly how you would feel leaving Egypt? Surprised by joy, by wonder and by marvels. But God's world hasn't run out of marvels, out of wonders, out of amazement, out of awe. And to be jaded, to be callous in the face of God's world is a kind of sin. Einstein said, we must live as if nothing is a miracle or everything is a miracle. Think about that for a minute, what it would be to feel amazement and wonder and a sense of the miraculous at every moment. What children have, what artists have. Great artists look at the world differently and they feel amazement at things that we take for granted. Picasso said it beautifully. He said, I'm amazed every day that I don't melt in the bathtub. Because he saw the world with a twist. He saw wonder and amazement and beauty, and that's what it means to see God in the world. It's to be constantly astonished, and in our day, astonishment and marvel, they're replaced by technology, by screens. But that wasn't what our ancestors saw. They saw the world. Not what human beings make of the world, but just the world. I was reminded of this because last week I took a pilgrimage, not to Israel, a shorter pilgrimage. For a lecture, I was in Boston. And so I drove for the first time in my life to Concord to see the home and the grave of Ralph Waldo Emerson, who was probably the most important American writer and philosopher, and who taught his neighbors, many of whom were famous writers and philosophers themselves, what it was to appreciate what he called the unguarded epiphanies of every blessed day. In other words, the things that you realize each day that you never saw before. It was Emerson who bought a small piece of property and gave it to his friend Thoreau to build a cabin there. It was called Walden. And on Walden Pond, Thoreau wrote the most important book of American naturalism, of the environment. And I went to Walden Pond and I looked, and if I hadn't known that Thoreau had written a famous book there, I would have said it's a lake. I've seen lakes before. It looked like every other lake. But I forced myself to really see it because I knew what Thoreau had said, that to be awake is to be alive. And I knew that he spent a year there, never leaving that place, acquainting himself with every creature, with every leaf, never reading a newspaper, never hearing the news from the city. In fact, he writes about his disdain for newspapers. He says, look, if you've read about one fire, it's enough for a lifetime. But he paid close attention to everything that went on around him, and his book is stuffed with wonders and marvels of things that we all see every single day. But like the Israelites emerging into a new world, he saw it anew. He understood the world differently. And he communicated with the people he loved and he knew, with Emerson, about this. And I know what Emerson used to do with his life. He would walk back and forth to different people's houses, nothing exceptional. In fact, he said very beautifully that you should go often to the house of your friend, because weeds choke the unused path. If you don't walk there, eventually weeds are going to come and you'll find the path is blocked. And you realize that what he's saying is not just about nature, it's about human relations. The person that you don't keep contact with, all of a sudden it becomes difficult because weeds choke the unused path. And I stood there at his grave and I saw something very beautiful, by the way. Emerson's grave is a huge marble boulder with a little plaque on it. Now, Emerson was a Unitarian. He was a Protestant. He was not a Jew, but when you come to his grave, at least when I went there, it was cold and windy and there wasn't a flower anywhere to be seen. But you know what there was on Emerson's grave? There were little stones. And I thought somebody picked up the Jewish custom of putting stones on his grave. And what a wonderful honor it is for someone whose insights are enduring. And so the first lesson of the Passover Seder, from the stories that we tell our children to the questions we tell them to ask, is to fill your life with wonder, with surprise, with marvels, with beauty. And that means, in part, seeing anew what you see every single day. Allow yourself to be dazzled by the wonder, surprised by the joy, and grateful for the blessing. That is, in part, what it means to see yourself not as a slave in Egypt, but as a slave who emerged from Egypt. And then there is the second lesson of the Pesach Seder, which is a lesson of letting go. You know that when the Israelites went out into the desert, what did they say to Moses? We want to go back. We were comfortable in Egypt. We knew Egypt. We lived there. We were okay there. And Moses had to teach them to let go of that which they knew and the way in which they had lived. There was in America In the 20th century, a famous family of acrobats called the Flying Willendas. And the patriarch of that family, Carl Willenda, did something that my father and I had discussed a number of times. Against advice, he stretched a wire across two 10-story towers of the Condado Plaza Hotel in San Juan, Puerto Rico, and decided he was going to walk across the wire. And halfway across, a huge gust of wind came, and he teetered back and forth as many spectators watched. And after trying to right himself unsuccessfully, he fell, and he died. And when the researchers went and found him, and they reconstructed the accident, they realized what it was that had made this famous and skillful person unable to cross to the tower successfully. Because when they found him, he was still clutching on to the balancing pole. The balancing pole, if you are a high wire walker, that is what enables you, through deft and careful manipulation, to keep your balance. If you move too much one way, you weight it the other way. Too much the other way, you weight it the first way. It is the essential tool to get from one place to the other, except when it isn't. Except in those rare cases when you have to let go of the balancing pole and grab onto the wire itself if you want to live. But Willenda's training was so powerful, and so used was he to the idea that the balancing pole is what would save him, that he couldn't let go, and as a result, he plunged to his death. It was Pharaoh's sin too. Why was Egypt subject to all these plagues? Because Pharaoh couldn't let go. He'd had these Israelites as slaves for so many years that the idea of letting them go was anathema to him. He couldn't accept it. He couldn't do it. So he held on until it destroyed him. Sometimes it is the very thing that gives us strength that holds us back. Pharaoh's army, the acrobat's balancing pole. But Moses is wiser. Remember, what is Moses? Really, what was Moses before he became the leader of the Jewish people? He was a shepherd. And what is the shepherd's essential tool? His staff. It's the staff that the shepherd uses to herd the sheep. And what is the first thing that God tells Moses to do when he sees him at the burning bush? He says, throw down your staff. And Moses learns that his strength isn't in what he holds on to, but sometimes in what he can let go. He lets go of his life in Midian, of his old presuppositions, and he goes on to the journey. And this, of course, this is the third lesson of Pesach. It is the lesson of the journey. When we had to choose a saying for Sinai Akiba, if you go up and you see the sayings on the wall, what we chose as a family was to put the saying from Martin Buber up there: all journeys have secret destinations of which the traveler is unaware. You think you know where you're going, but you never know where you're going. There's an old Jewish story about the rabbi who leaves his home in the morning and the policeman stops him and he says, where are you going? And the rabbi won't answer. And the policeman says, you better tell me where you're going. The rabbi doesn't answer. And the policeman says, if you don't tell me where you're going, I'm bringing you to jail. And the rabbi still won't answer, and he brings him and puts him in jail. And he comes up before the judge. And the judge says to him, I don't understand you. He just asked you where you were going. Why didn't you answer? And the rabbi said, well, I don't like to lie. And the truth is, I thought I was going to the synagogue, but you never really know where you were going, because after all, look where I ended up. I'm in court. When you take the first step, you don't know where you're going, which leads me to a very minor confession. I really like airports. I know you're not supposed to like airports, but I really do. Because, except for the security line, which I don't like so much, the airport is part of the journey. It's not the place you have to go to get somewhere. It's actually already part of the journey. Think of all the people you see in the airport that you would never see if you stayed at home. And if you don't know the joy of sitting in an airport and watching people walk by, then you're missing the journey. There's something wonderful about it. It plays the same role the train stations used to play in older times. It's a gathering place and a place where people go variously on their separate journeys. Have you had the experience ever of being in the airport and you see someone and then you're astonished to discover that even though you saw them at curbside, they're on the same plane? And you feel like, wow, the intersection of how people move together and move apart in this world is quite wonderful, and you never know whom you will meet on the journey or where you will go. That's why the rabbi said that the merit of going to the house of study is in the running. Not in the study, but in the running. It's the journey itself that proves to be so important. I went to Emerson's house because for so many years I had taken an internal journey of reading him and thinking about his life. And I wanted to actually walk some of the steps that he walked and see the places that he saw. That's what the Haggadah is. The Haggadah is a journey. You never get to Israel in the Haggadah. Has that ever struck you? You never get there. Year after year after year, we read the Haggadah, we never get to Israel. Even if you're in Israel, at the end of the Haggadah, you say, next year in a rebuilt Jerusalem. There is no end to the journey. That's part of the message. If you start the journey thinking that the only thing that matters is the destination, then you miss everything that happens between the beginning and the end. It's all about the steps of the journey. The destination is far less important because everything that is interesting, everything that is beautiful, everything that is painful, everything that is deepening, everything that is wondrous, everything that is tragic, it all happens along the way. So let me tell you a story. It is a beautiful folk parable about a woman who sets her foot on the path of life and she says to the guide of life, is the way long? And he says, yes, the way of life is long and it is hard and you will be old before you reach the end, but you will find at the end the meaning of the beginning and of the whole journey. And she was happy. And she couldn't believe that anything would be better than her early years. She played with her children and she bathed them in clear streams and she walked them through the sun. And she cried to herself, these are the best times of my life. Nothing will ever approach the beauty and the wonder of this time. And then the night came. And the path was dark. And the children shook with fear and they cried. And they were cold, and the woman drew them close and put her mantle around them to warm them. And they said, we are not afraid, not anymore, because you are with us. And the woman said, this is better than the brightness of the day, because now I have taught my children courage. And the morning came. And along the path there were hills and mountains, and they were difficult. And it was hard to climb them. And she had to urge her children on. and forced them to go forward. But finally they got to the top. And they turned to her and said, "We could not have gotten to the top without you." And she said, "Now this is better than anything that has come before. Because now I taught them patience and fortitude and perseverance. Yesterday I gave my children courage, but today I have given them strength." And then the next day came, with strange clouds that darkened the earth. And they saw evil and war and hate. And the children groped and they stumbled. And they didn't know what to do. And a terror gripped their soul. And the woman said, "Look and lift your eyes up to the light." And they did. And above the clouds they saw an everlasting glory that guided them beyond the darkness. And the mother said, This is the best day of all, because I have shown my children God and I have given them faith." And the years went on, and the woman grew old and bent and frail. And now her children had to help her along and sometimes carry her when she couldn't walk. And they came to a last hill, and beyond the hill they could see a gate, a beautiful white gate. And the woman said to her children, "Now I've reached the end of my journey, but it is good, because I know that my children can walk alone and take care of their children after them." And the children said, "No, you will always walk with us. Even after you pass through the gate, you will be inside of us, you will walk with us, we will never be alone." And they stood and they watched as she walked on, and the doors swung shut behind her. And that's the story. The story is that we have to appreciate the wonders of this life, be enchanted by its marvels, be dazzled by its beauty, that we have to learn to hold on, but we also have to learn to let go. And at each step, for us, for those who have taught us, for those we love, for those who are here, and for those who are gone, we have to treasure the journey. Those are the lessons of life and the story of Passover. May we all be blessed. Chag Sameach.